Welcome to the Federalist Society's Courthouse Steps podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedures, Federalism and Separation of Powers, and International and National Security Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, November 5th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing a case argued in the Supreme Court today, U.S. versus Bond. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to welcome back today two return guests to our program to discuss this very important case, as it itself returned to the Supreme Court this morning. As always, their complete bios are in your inboxes, so I'm going to be extremely brief in my introductions. Professor Nicholas Quinn Rosenkranz is at the Georgetown University Law Center. I believe he filed an amicus brief in this case and has followed it extremely closely, and we're very pleased to have him here. And we're joined also by Professor John Eastman, who's director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence and the Henry Salvatori Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University School of Law. We're going to get opening remarks from each of them in about 15 minutes each, and then some discussion between the two of them, and then, as always, questions from the audience, so please be ready with your questions. And with that, Professor Rosenkranz, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. I'm happy to be with you on your teleforum. So this case, Bond v. United States, is fantastic, first because it has such lurid facts. So Mrs. Bond discovered that her husband had an affair with her friend and neighbor, and so Mrs. Bond got some toxic chemicals and spread them on the doorknob of the neighbor, and also on her car door, and also on her doormat, and also, I believe, on her mailbox. And so this conduct is, of course, obviously all sorts of different state crime, but she was not prosecuted for those state crimes. Instead, she was prosecuted by an ambitious assistant U.S. attorney for the violation of a federal statute, which is the Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act. And so Mrs. Bond prosecuted by this under this federal statute, and Mrs. Bond wants to argue, where does Congress get the power to enact this statute? Whence the congressional power? In general, when we're looking for Congress's power, we take a look at Article 1, Section 8, which is a big list of enumerated powers of Congress. Mrs. Bond says, I've had a look at that list, and I don't see any enumerated power over this subject. So how is it that Congress gets this power? The first thing that happened is the government said, you, Mrs. Bond, don't even have standing to make that argument. That's the kind of argument that only states can make. Individuals can't quite make that sort of argument. You don't have standing. That point convinced the Third Circuit last year, but then it went to the Supreme Court last year, and the Solicitor General confessed error and said, that's wrong, actually. We do think that Mrs. Bond has standing. So then both sides agreed she had standing, and 9-0, the Supreme Court said, of course, Mrs. Bond has standing to make this argument. Then the case went back to the Third Circuit, and Mrs. Bond got to make her argument. So she said, I don't see where Congress gets power to enact this federal statute. And the government makes this interesting argument, which is it doesn't matter that you don't see that power listed in Article 1, Section 8, and the reason is there's this treaty. We have entered into a treaty called the Chemical Weapons Convention, and thus Congress automatically gets the power to enact this statute, even if they would have lacked the power otherwise. So the treaty, as it were, increases the legislative power of Congress, gives Congress new power that it wouldn't have had otherwise. And for that proposition, they cite a very old case called Missouri v. Holland, 1920, in which Justice Holmes seemed to say that. And so the Third Circuit agreed, said we have to agree because the Supreme Court seemed to say that in Missouri v. Holland, but we are uneasy with that conclusion, and we urged the Supreme Court to take another look at this. And so that was our case today. The Supreme Court granted cert, and it posed this very deep, important, fundamental question of constitutional law, which is, can a treaty increase the legislative power of Congress? Does Congress have finite powers listed in the Constitution, or potentially infinite powers, anything listed plus anything that we can reach by treaty? That was the that's the deep, important, fundamental question that was at issue in the case, which they heard today. And the argument was, I was in the courtroom today. Argument was very interesting. There were clearly all nine justices were very engaged and interested. And there were hard questions for both sides. So each of the justices had, or many of the justices had, some very skeptical questions for the government. But there were also some skeptical questions for Paul Clement, Mrs. Bond's lawyer. Paul is a former Solicitor General and perhaps the most accomplished appellate advocate in the country. So it was extremely high-quality lawyering on both sides. And the court was clearly interested and had questions for everybody and some skeptical questions for both sides. And, you know, I can perhaps offer a bit of a prediction, but I'll maybe do that a little later in the call. I guess that tees up the issues for us, and I'd love to hear what John has to say. Just a note, you introduced John, but you didn't mention he actually also helped in our amicus brief. So John and I were both on a brief for the Cato Institute in this case, which we hope that the court is considering at this very moment. John, what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, thanks, Nick, and you should not be so humble on your own role in this. One of the things that's happened over the last century is there was a good deal of scholarship supporting Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes' conclusion, bald statement in Missouri versus Holland a century ago, that the mere adoption of a treaty is sufficient to give Congress whatever power is necessary to implement that treaty. And it was based on some faulty scholarship that had been done. And that Nick has exposed, that somebody just misread the records of the Federal Convention debates and got the scholarship wrong. And in fact, if you look at this in the larger context of the very idea of limited government, the notion that we could enter into a treaty that would do more than just control the relationship between our nation and other nations, but would control how our nation has to deal with its own citizens for domestic matters, and that by entering into that treaty, we could expand the powers of the federal government vis-a-vis the states or individual citizens, completely undermines any notion of limited government. And it's one of the reasons why this interpretation that's been given at Missouri versus Holland is one of the top 10 targets of our litigation effort at the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which I head, because it's a very dangerous threat to limited government generally. And this case and the facts of this case just demonstrate how clear that is. If Congress concededly has no power to regulate domestic assaults that use chemicals, that when there's no connection with interstate commerce, the fact that we enter into a treaty cannot possibly give Congress the power that the Constitution doesn't otherwise give it. And that's the very significant, important question in this case. And the Supreme Court is grappling with it in a very serious way. And looking at the transcript of the argument, and you know, I don't have the nuances of the inflections of the voices that Nick was able to have being there, but it quite readily appears that Justice Alito and Scalia and the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy and even Justice Breyer are very skeptical of a rule that would say I can do anything by treaty and thereby expand the powers of government even to the detriment of the states or the citizenry. And that's a very good thing from that argument. If the court would to enter such a rule, or at least move significantly in that direction and curtail the scope of Missouri versus Holland, that would be a big win for limited government. And let me put it in another context, a century-long discussion. In the 1950s, the court was confronted with a related question, and that is, can we basically eliminate protections of the Bill of Rights because we've entered into a treaty? What was at issue in a case called Reed versus Covert in the 1950s was a treaty we had with Great Britain that was designed to protect our military personnel who were stationed on bases in England. And it said that anybody, military personnel that were charged with a crime committed in England would be prosecuted by a military tribunal on our base rather than in the English courts. But the treaty extended that to the spouses and other family dependents who were at the base with our military personnel. And, of course, a spouse of one of our soldiers or airmen who was stationed over there said, well, wait a minute, I have a right to a trial by jury, not by military tribunal. I'm not in the military. And the fact that you've entered into a treaty cannot curtail my Bill of Rights. And in Reed versus Colbert, the Supreme Court agreed that the treaty power could not be used to circumvent protections of the Bill of Rights. Well, this is the mirror image of that. The treaty power shouldn't be able to be used to circumvent the limits of the enumerated powers doctrine either. The fact that one's a power grant rather than an explicit limitation it does not alter the theory that the treaty power can't be used to give Congress the authority to do something it otherwise doesn't have the constitutional authority to do. That's why this case is so important, to reconcile that holding in Reed versus Covert with the opposite holding in Missouri versus Holland, and quite frankly to overrule Missouri versus Holland and get us back on the track toward limited government. And then for those of you that are following the international field, the importance of this case will not escape your attention, because increasingly U.S. Proponents of various policies that cannot get through the legislature or for which there's no constitutional authority to get through the legislature are seeking to implement by way of international treaties those policies that they don't have constitutional authority to implement at home. And this case, Carol Ann Bond's case in the United States Supreme Court, will hopefully put a significant brake on those kind of efforts.
Very good. Thank you both for those remarks. Before we go to our audience for questions, let me ask Professor Rosenkranz if you want to augment your opening remarks in any way now that you've heard from Professor Eastman.
Sure, just briefly. I mean, I agree with everything John said, and his point about Reed v. Covert is an excellent one. So the court, so there's this tension between these two old cases. Missouri v. Holland seems to say that if you enter into a treaty that promises to do something that's beyond the enumerated powers, that Congress automatically gets the power to do that thing. Reed v. Covert, by contrast, says that if you enter into a treaty that promises to violate the Bill of Rights, you don't automatically get the power to violate the Bill of Rights. The treaty cannot give you that power. And Reed v. Covert is, I think everyone agrees, is correct, but it's in deep tension with Missouri. And the question is, why shouldn't the rule be the same when you're talking about enumerated powers and structure of the federal government as when you're talking about the Bill of Rights? So I think John put it perfectly, and that is exactly what's at issue here. Overruling Missouri v. Holland would, you know, bring these two lines of doctrine into harmony, which is where they belong.
And Dean, let me add one thing. The court may not reach as far as I would like or Nick would like the important questions here. Paul Clement gave them a statutory narrowing construction of the statute at issue here that might lead some of the justices to say, well, we'll accept that narrowing interpretation of the statute so we don't have to confront the constitutional question out of their normal constitutional avoidance doctrines. We avoid constitutional questions wherever we can. I hope they don't do that. This statute seems pretty clear. It was used for just this purpose, and it has nothing to do with an international obligation. It was an expansive treaty interpreted to allow Congress to do things that the commerce power doesn't already allow it to do. And I hope they will confront the ultimate constitutional question here as a result. But at the very least, I would expect at least very strong concurring opinions to that effect, perhaps by Justice Thomas or Justice Alito. There were others on the court that seem inclined that direction as well.
Let's open it up to questions from the audience. In a moment, you'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the audience, let me make our typical programming announcement. We've got three more Teleforum conference calls this week. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll have another special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum as we discuss the Town of Greece case. That's a legislative prayer case being argued this week in the Supreme Court. On Thursday, another book Teleforum with author Peter Schweitzer and Eileen O'Connor. And that's Thursday at noon Eastern Time. And then on Friday, as I keep reminding, an early time for a Teleforum conference call, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum, this one on the Medtronic intellectual property case. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the audience, let me ask a question of Professor Rosenkranz. On this, sort of statutory interpretation out that Paul Clement offered up, was that in the briefs? I guess that's the first part of the question. And was it offered up in the regular course of his argument, or what was the reason for that? Is it an escape hatch for him, or was he not confident in the broader argument? Or I wonder if you want to say more about that.
Sure. So it was in the briefs, and it was in his oral argument today, this statutory interpretation point. Just to be clear, so the statute on its face seems like it covers Mrs. Bond, seems like she fits within the language of the statute. But Paul says, well, if you could just interpret the statute narrowly so that it doesn't reach Mrs. Bond, then you wouldn't have this problem of having to contend with Missouri v. Holland and can a treaty increase the legislative power of Congress. And even though that's a strained reading of the statute, it might appeal to some of the justices to avoid the hard question, and indeed there's a canon for that, which is called the canon of constitutional avoidance. So the court generally does try to interpret statutes, if at all possible, to avoid difficult constitutional questions. Now, I'm inclined to agree with John. I think the statute is so clear that it is not won't be an easy opinion to write. But it might well appeal to some of the justices to take the statutory interpretation route.
And I will say this, the textual interpretation of the statute, which both Nick and I think is fairly clear-cut, led to some of the great moments in the oral argument. And Justice Alito admitted that he and his wife on a couple days earlier, which would have been Halloween evening, distributed chemicals in violation of the chemical ban because chocolate is a hazardous substance to certain kinds of animals. And, you know, there were a couple of points like that. But if you follow a strict interpretation of the statute, those could be reached by this international treaty and implementing legislation banning chemical weapons because the chemicals would have been used in a way that might have caused harm to people or animals.
The statute's extraordinarily broad as written. It seems to include the use of any chemical to harm any person or animal. So it would include use of rat poison. It would include pouring vinegar into a goldfish bowl. It would include, as Justice Alito pointed out, distributing, you know, chocolate on Halloween if your intent was that the chocolate was going to end up fed to a dog that it would kill or whatever. So the statute on its face is breathtakingly broad, and I think the justices all are nervous about that. So they will be inclined, it seemed like several of them would be inclined either to narrow the statute or to reach the Missouri v. Holland question and say Congress does not have power to do this.
We've got three callers on the line with questions so far. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Oh, hi, this is Edmund Williamson. Nick and John, thank you both for doing this. It was interesting. I also went to the argument and I found it, and I'm not a great Supreme Court expert, but I thought it was fascinating. I thought Paul did an amazingly good job. I'd like to just make a few points that in disagreement with the way you characterized the case, or really to talk a little bit about Missouri versus Holland. First, I think the statement that you, Justice Holmes' statement that you referred to is really dictum. In Missouri versus Holland, let's remember that the facts were a treaty between the U.S. and Canada with respect to, you know, among other things, the hunting rules with respect to migratory birds, such as the length of the duck season. So Congress has adopted and the executive branch has adopted regulations implementing those restrictions, and Missouri said, no, we have different rules with respect to duck hunting. I was always puzzled by this case and kind of wondered why they didn't just take the easy way out on interstate commerce. But in fact, there is an area in there where the treaty-making power entails powers to do things which do go beyond Article 1. And I think dealing with migratory non-interstate commerce birds is an example. Treaties with respect to repayment of debts to Brits after the revolution and so forth, is another example.
Was that a question?
Well, I'm going to play it for a little personal privilege here, since we sort of have one side being presented. So I would argue that Missouri versus Holland is not really a threat, and either the statutory interpretation pushed by Paul or a ruling that says that this application of the implementing legislation does go beyond Congress's power because it doesn't fit in with the necessary and proper clause is where I believe the court will come out, and it doesn't really limit Missouri versus Holland, but it does clarify Justice Holmes' dissent. Dictum. I'm sorry, there's no question mark at the end of that.
There's a good question mark, and let me take it up. This is John Eastman. A couple of things. One, Missouri versus Holland has been interpreted as allowing Congress to do anything that implements a treaty, whether or not it had the independent constitutional power to do so. That the treaty clause was all the authority Congress needed. And at the time Missouri versus Holland was decided, of course, hunting migratory birds was not considered something to be within the coverage of the Commerce Clause, because the birds were not commerce and the hunting of them did not involve interstate, even if the birds may have moved interstate. We've got a broader view of the commerce authority now, whether right or wrong is immaterial. At the time, it was conceded that it exceeded Congress's commerce power. And if they said, well, this is implementing something about that has a direct relation with foreign affairs and our dealings with Canada, and it's a self-executing treaty, something that the justices today focused extensively on, the difference between a self-executing treaty dealing with foreign affairs like that would have, or something that required implementation by statute of Congress when it concededly otherwise exceeded its authority. And that's an important line to draw. And Justice Alito, I think, focused on the fact that what we're talking about here is an expansion on what can be covered by treaties. Obviously, dealing with debts due to foreign nationals as a result of the Revolutionary War could be accomplished by treaty, even if Congress couldn't have that power. And so I suppose you could have an implementation of the Chemical Weapons Ban Treaty that would say if Mrs. Bond was attacking with chemicals somebody who was visiting here from France, that would be a subject that could be reached by the treaty. But that's not what's going on here. We're talking about Mrs. Bond dealing with another United States citizen, having nothing to do with interstate commerce, operating exclusively within Pennsylvania, that is nevertheless going to be reached by Congress simply because it claims that we can do anything we want to enforce a treaty that gives it the extraordinary power that really does derive from that line of Justice Holmes in Missouri versus Holland that I think has been very expansively interpreted by the lower courts, and it's an expansive interpretation that needs to be shut down.
Professor Rosenkranz, you want to respond here?
I agree with John and Edwin with respect. I have to disagree with you that sentence is dictum. I mean, it has been interpreted quite broadly, but it was necessary to decide the case. So in Missouri v. Holland, the lower courts had struck down the statute as beyond Congress's Commerce Clause power. And then then we went ahead and entered into this treaty and then reenacted the same statute. So for the court to get to that question, they had to decide that the treaty was giving Congress power that they didn't otherwise have. So I don't agree that it's dicta. I certainly agree, though, that it's just one sentence, and it was utterly unreasoned in the opinion. And the question wasn't even really squarely presented by the parties in that case. So the court shouldn't really feel too bound by that. I think the stare decisis force of that should be is certainly diminished by the lack of any argument in its favor, any reasons in its favor. So I think the court, and interestingly, the argument today, Missouri v. Holland was only invoked a couple of times, I think, if that. So I don't think even the government is quite relying on that one sentence to get it to the finish line here.
Once again, if you'd like to join the queue for questions, we have one question pending at this point. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Thank you for this discussion. My name is John Rodabaugh, and I'm a labor lawyer, so I'm not knowledgeable on many of these issues, but I'm interested in what I've read, which is in the world of international and comparative labor law, the international labor conventions of the ILO and so forth. From what I've read, and perhaps I have not understood, but Congress can go through the process of adopting some, agreeing to them. I understand the president can do it also independently. I'm not sure what subject matter draws a line between Congress doing it versus the president, but I'm concerned here at the end of the day that federal labor law and federal labor law principles could be trumped simply by one or the other agreeing to an international convention or foreign treaty. In 2009, Supreme Court of Canada overruled three provincial Supreme Court decisions saying you got it right in each of the three cases, but since you've decided these cases, the government of Canada adopted ILO Conventions 87 and 98, therefore it trumps your law. And I would love to hear from you about your concerns for this.
Well, I guess I'd just say that's quite an interesting issue, but it's not exactly our issue or not exactly the issue of today. So it's pretty well established that the Congress already has power over labor law. And so a new treaty concerning labor law wouldn't quite raise our issue. Because the issue here is whether a treaty can do things beyond the enumerated powers of Congress that Congress otherwise get to. This is a thing that Congress can otherwise get to. So it's not quite our case, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, and let me unpack it a little bit further, because I think we can change the question a little bit and create hypotheticals that show each of the different three boxes that these issues might be placed in. So suppose by treaty we tell people that labor unions can compel folks to contribute to the unions, whether they're members or not, and that those funds can be used for political purposes in direct violation of Beck and other Supreme Court cases, including Knox versus SEIU just last term, that says that violates the First Amendment. A treaty that mandated that would be illegal, and that would be the Reed versus Covert case. Let's suppose instead we change it
I'll just disagree with you and say the treaty wouldn't be illegal. It just simply wouldn't empower Congress to do that.
Well, under Reed
John Eastman, I don't know if you're speaking, but we can't hear you any longer. I don't know if your phone has been muted.
I quit hearing you folks. I thought they were talking.
Oh, I'm still on. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I can hear you now, John Eastman. Go right ahead.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So because it would violate the First Amendment, the treaty itself to that extent would be invalid. That's the Reed versus Covert decision. And so let me change the hypothetical a little bit more and say, suppose we had a very small business where the labor relations between the employer and employee for some reason could not be reached by Congress's power under the Interstate Commerce Clause, and that a treaty nevertheless sought to regulate that business and gave Congress the authority via implementing regulation to reach that business. If we accept the proposition that that would have exceeded Congress's power under the Commerce Clause ab initio, then the treaty would not be able to give them the authority to do that. That's the fight we have right now. That's the Missouri versus Holland fight. And then the third box is, let's assume Congress has the power and they pass statutes that say you can't do X, but by international treaty we say Congress can do X or labor relations can do X. The treaty would prevail over the previously enacted statute, but we don't have the question of Congress's authority there. We only have the question in which was last in time, and that seems to be the box that your question puts us in.
Right. Well, thank you. And the Reed versus, it's C-O-V-E-R, is that covert?
C-O-V-E-R-T.
Oh, thank you so much.
Reed versus covert.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Two questions pending at this point. Let's go to our next caller.
Well, since no one jumped in, this is Edwin Williamson back again. Let me just make another couple of comments. I think there's no question about it that the position basically adopting Paul Clement's arguments will be very, very helpful in stopping this trend towards the use of treaties to do an end run around either the necessity for legislation or even constitutional issues. Second point is just to emphasize here is that this case is not about the validity of the treaty. This case is about the validity of the implementing legislation as applied in this case to a purely local situation without a national or international nexus. So there are lots of structural impediments to the treaty-making power in the Constitution, not only the Bill of Rights, but I have a question as well, not commandeering, for example, would be a valid treaty exercise, and et cetera. But again, Missouri versus Holland is like this case, would be like this case only if in the implementing legislation, Congress also attempted to set quail hunting seasons in addition to the duck hunting seasons.
Very good. No, one of the lines that the court tried to draw here is the difference between a self-executing treaty, which Paul seemed to think these kind of actions would be okay under a self-executing treaty, and a treaty that required implementing legislation from Congress. And Paul's point there was, if the treaty agrees that we will, through our law, pass domestic legislation to further the treaty, it has to be the case that that necessarily means we will do it through our law according to the constitutional structures we have set out. And if that means that we're asking Congress to do something that it has no constitutional authority to do, then the implementation of that treaty would require pushing through a constitutional amendment or enlisting voluntarily the support of the states to take the actions that the treaty has requested the United States to urge that they take. But that beyond that, Congress doesn't have the authority to simply implement the treaty. And the line that Holmes says in Missouri versus Holland is, the very fact that there's a treaty is by definition sufficient authority for Congress to do whatever the treaty commits us to do. And that's the position Paul said can't possibly be right. And I think he's right about that.
Nick, you have anything further on this point?
Nope, I agree with John.
Okay, let's go to our next caller then. Again, if you'd like to join the queue, we have just one question pending. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. There may be a silent or perhaps not so silent invocation in all of this of the necessary and proper clause, because if it were applied to the treaty power and carrying into execution were interpreted as broadly as it was uninterpreted by McCulloch v. Maryland, one, you know, to go way beyond mere administrative or incidental powers, then, you know, Katie barred the door. So what did we hear in all of this about reining in the necessary and proper clause if it were to be invoked, in, even if silently, to make sure that we're not talking about new powers, but only about administrative action?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's actually a little bit disappointing to me that the court did not mention any constitutional text, really, in the argument. John and I, in our brief, did actually carefully parse the necessary and proper clause and the treaty clause to see if this was a plausible reading of these two clauses, and we conclude that it isn't. So the clause you're referring to says the Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution all other power, all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. The treaty power is an other power, so it does connect up with the necessary and proper clause. But when you connect them up, here's what you get. The Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution, the power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties. And a point that we make in our brief is, yes, the necessary and proper clause has been interpreted very broadly. The terms necessary and proper have been interpreted very broadly. But here, the power is merely the power to make laws necessary and proper to bring into execution the power to make treaties, and to bring treaties into existence, to negotiate them and sign them. Whereas that's not what's at issue in this case. This is a statute that is implementing a treaty that's already been made. This is a Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act. This is not a statute that helps anybody to make a treaty. This is a statute that implements a treaty already made. And that's a distinction that the court has seen clearly in another context. So talking about the phrase to make contracts, the court has said, quote, the right to make contracts does not extend as a matter of either logic or semantics to conduct after the contract relation has been established, including breach of the terms of the contract. Such post-formation conduct does not involve the right to make a contract, but rather implicates the performance of established contract obligations. And, you know, I think that same logic could apply to the phrase to make treaties in the Constitution when connected up with the necessary and proper clause. However broadly one reads necessary and proper, the object still has to be proper, and the object here has to be the object of making treaties.
And I want to add, I would encourage everybody to look at Nick's brilliant law review article in the 2005 issue of the Harvard Law Review called Executing the Treaty Power. It had become the scholarly status quo over the course of the last century that there was this broader connection between necessary and proper and the treaty power, because the necessary and proper clause, it was claimed, originally had specific reference to expanding on the treaty power to implement treaties, and that language was deleted in the convention, implying, therefore, that the limitation was no longer there. Nick points out in a brilliant piece of scholarly architecture that the clause was never part of the necessary and proper clause. It was part of the militia clause. The professor that engaged upon this scholarship just misread the debates of the Federal Convention, and it really does dramatically alter our understanding of what happened as those clauses were being put together. Nick's done a terrific job in uncovering that problem, I think refuting it definitively, and one only hopes the court looks at our table of authorities for the article and reads a little more into it than they were able to get into the oral argument today.
Thanks very much, John. That's nice of you to say. You know, just to expand on that for a second, this this mistaken bit of scholarship really short-circuited any textual analysis at all. Nobody quite ever tried to piece together how these clauses actually read because this constitutional history purported to be so authoritative. I mean, it purported to be crystal clear that the framers had thought this through, added the phrase, and then taken the phrase out because they thought it was unnecessary. And that was so compelling that it basically obviated the need to do any textual analysis. But now that we know that that's actually false, it is going to be necessary for the court to actually have a look at the text of the Constitution. And when they have a look, I think they're going to find that there is no reason to believe that a treaty can increase the power of Congress.
If I may follow, though, there's a gap in our jurisprudence on the phrase, the limiting phrase, carrying in execution. There's been a lot of attention to what is necessary or proper, but carrying in execution is much more restrictive, as originally understood, than it has become in later decisions, which seem to be indicating that it is not only necessary and proper to get a desired outcome and not merely to carry out one's duties under the powers that one already has.
Well, so I agree with you. These phrases have all been interpreted quite broadly, and you and I might prefer for necessary and proper to be construed more narrowly, and we might prefer for execution to be construed more narrowly. But for this purpose, we don't actually need any of that. Even given the broadest possible interpretation of those phrases, it's at the end of the day, it's necessary and proper to bring into execution the power to make treaties. And there is no sense in which this statute is necessary and proper to make any treaties.
Well, I can certainly imagine somebody, a clever lawyer, arguing that we couldn't make a treaty unless we could implement a previous treaty by doing something we didn't have the power to do. So therefore, we had to have the power to do it to make the next treaty.
We can't let our constitutional interpretation be set by whatever clever lawyers can come up with, though, or we're at a loss from the get-go.
you could imagine a parallel argument about the appointments power. So the appointments power is in Article 2. The president has power to make appointments. You could say, well, the president's appointment power will be aided by this new statute. You know, imagine Justice Kagan. The president wants to appoint Justice Kagan to be a Supreme Court justice, and she says, I'll only take the job if you'll pass a statute that regulates guns near schools. Well, okay, so then I guess passing that statute would be an aid to his appointments power, but surely it can't be right that a naked demand from an appointee could somehow vest Congress with new power. And the analogy is the same. A naked demand from France that they won't enter into a new treaty with us unless we pass some statute beyond enumerated powers can't be that demand somehow gives Congress new power.
Let's take one more question. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, my name is Chris Gardner. I'm a student at George Mason Law. You made the distinction between self-executing treaties and non-self-executing treaties. And perhaps I misheard, but it sounded like you were saying that had this treaty been self-executing, that would have been fine. But since it was non-self-executing, Congress didn't have the expanded authority to implement the law, to make new laws to implement the treaty. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about that, because that just doesn't seem like it can be right that Congress would, that the Senate and the President would be able to completely bypass the House and expand power just by changing some words in the treaty that they otherwise could not enact.
I agree,
John,
with you.
Sorry, John, you...
You want to go, Nick?
Yeah. Sure, yeah, let me... just to clarify for others on the call, there's this distinction between self-executing treaties, which are domestic law of their own force. They are here in the U.S., they are like a statute. They have the same legal effect and power as a federal statute. Mm-hmm. Non-self-executing treaties, by contrast, are just promises. They're international agreements and they're international law by which we promise that we'll do something, but the treaty doesn't itself create domestic law. The domestic law is created by a federal statute. Now, to clarify, I think John suggested that Paul had said that if this treaty were self-executing, it would be fine. I didn't understand him to take that position. I think Paul would be arguing against this, even if it were self-executing, and he did seem to say that at oral arguments. So, you know, I think Paul actually thinks this would be problematic either way. But I do think there's a difference, and Justice Scalia actually at oral argument made clear that he thought there was a difference between a self-executing treaty and a non-self-executing treaty followed by a statute. The difference is they're just different powers in different parts of the Constitution. So Article 2 gives the president the treaty power, and we have to figure out what the scope of that power is, what a legitimate treaty might be. But there's no reason to think that the scope of that power is exactly the same as the scope of Article 1, Section 8, and I don't think it is. I think a treaty can actually go beyond Article 1, Section 8. A self-executing treaty could. But a non-self-executing treaty, you have to ask yourself both questions. You have to ask yourself the Article 2 question, is this a valid treaty? And then you have to ask yourself the Article 1 question of, does Congress have power to enact this legislation? And the answers to those two questions might be different. So it's, I think, completely coherent for Paul to say, this is a fine treaty, but it does not vest Congress with the authority to pass this legislation. And that's really what's at issue in this case.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And one of the problems is the line between self-executing and non-self-executing treaty doesn't help us answer whether the treaty itself is valid. And there may be some things that we can do by treaty that Congress could not do directly by Article 1, Section 8, such as requiring people to pay an obligation on a debt owed to a foreign national that would have been relinquished because of the Revolutionary War. And Congress may not have that power directly, but we might have that power by the treaty. That would perhaps allow us to reach directly to Carol Anne Bond if she is using her chemicals to cause harm to a Frenchman who's visiting here, because that would be the proper subject for a treaty, how we internally deal with foreign nationals in the United States. But it would not be something that's susceptible to congressional legislation, because regulating that domestic purpose would be beyond their commerce authority, and so it would require a self-executing treaty. So we might have to parse valid and invalid self-executing treaties a little bit more carefully before we just accept everything if it's a self-executing treaty, and then none of it if it requires implementation with powers that Congress does not have.
And maybe I'll just say one other word on that. The instinct behind the question is, you know, how can you be troubled by a non-self-executing treaty followed by a statute? If you're not troubled by the self-executing treaty, it would seem that the non-self-executing treaty followed by the statute was better. I mean, there was at least more democratic legitimacy and more process before state laws got preempted. So the instinct might be, well, surely the non-self-executing treaty is less problematic from a sort of federalism standpoint. But I actually don't think so. You know, a self-executing treaty, because it's domestic law of its own force, it has to be quite specific. It has to really kind of spell out what it is prohibiting on the ground. And that's a real opportunity for, you know, state governors to call their senators and say, you know, don't ratify this thing because this is going to preempt all kinds of state law, and sort of raise the federalism concern at that phase. By contrast, a non-self-executing treaty is usually quite aspirational in its language. It's very kind of general and aspirational, and it talks about very kind of nice-sounding things about human rights and whatnot, and when the governor calls the senator in that story, the senator says, don't worry. This is non-self-executing. This is going to have no effect on your domestic law. Don't you worry about it. Then we enter into the treaty, and then perhaps a decade later, Congress decides that they want to have an entire federal law of human rights or whatever it is, and the treaty is lying around like a loaded gun. It's just like a new legislative power over whatever was the kind of broad general subject of this treaty. So I actually think that's a much more insidious and dangerous process than the simple self-executing treaty.
Let me make a final call for questions here. We have no questions pending. If you want to ask the final question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone quickly. Seeing none, why don't we give each of our speakers an opportunity? Actually, here's one final question. Let's take this from one of our callers.
Sorry, I gave 15 seconds for somebody else to jump in, so this is Edwin Williamson again. Just a quick couple of comments. I just totally disagree with your that there's the concept that there's a difference between self-executing validity of self-executing treaties versus non-self-executing treaties in this context. I'll admit that there was a line of questions that Justice Scalia put forward, but I want to go back and listen to them. To me, it makes no sense for there to be a difference in terms of Congress's power or the Senate's power. On the necessary and proper clause, Nick, you may be right, and I'll admit once again that I have not read that article. I'm going to read it now, I promise, once again. That issue is not going to be addressed here because what is now the conventional interpretation of the necessary and proper clause is not met, and that was in Paul Clement's argument. The statute as applied was not necessary to the U.S.'s fulfillment of its treaty obligations.
Dean, I thought you said that reading my article was going to be a prerequisite to being on the call.
I cheated.
I'll just give I don't think was a question. I can give just a 2-minute impression of the argument. There were a lot of hard questions for both sides, and the kind of hard questions were interesting. They were on both sides. The difficult questions were about how are we going to draw these lines. So for Paul's challenge was framed largely as an as-applied challenge. So he really wanted to focus the court's attention on Mrs. Bond's particular, extremely local facts. And that, of course, had a lot of intuitive appeal. The court clearly had the intuition that something had gone wrong because this was a federal prosecution of such an obviously local crime. But when you start to push on that question, what exactly is the principle? How local did the crime have to be? And what if she had put poison on 30 doorknobs? And what if her intent had been really to scare the whole neighborhood? Or what if the neighbor had actually been the Russian ambassador or something? I mean, once you start to push on quite how do you gerrymander exactly the kinds of cases that you think are too local for this statute, those are the sort of hard set of questions that Paul was presented with because he wanted to focus on Mrs. Bond's narrow facts rather than the sort of general principle, did Congress have power to enact this thing, period, quite regardless of who it was applied to. So that was this hard set of questions for Paul. Now, the hard set of questions for the government was about are you claiming that there are no limits at all on what Congress could get at given a proper treaty? So the Chief Justice asked the Solicitor General, if we enter into a treaty promising that Congress will have plenary legislative power or have a plenary police power, you know, just in order to reassure our treaty partners that we'll be able to fulfill all treaty obligations in the future, does it follow then that Congress would then have a plenary police power? Could a treaty give Congress what the court has always said that it lacks, which is a general police power? And that was a very hard question for the Solicitor General. He wanted to say, well, you know, I think such a treaty is very implausible or unlikely or whatever. But the Chief's point was, as a structural matter, you think that if we could get that through the Senate, then suddenly Congress would have a plenary police power? And the Solicitor General really didn't like that question. That was an awkward question for him. So, but he was not willing to own up to any particular line beyond which Congress could not go, given a treaty. So for both of them, they were both presented with these difficult questions of, what exactly line are you wanting for us to draw? How are we going to write this opinion?
And several members of the court took the hard line. Here's the money quote from Justice Kagan. I mean, Holmes dealt with this in Missouri versus Holland, she says. He says there's a treaty power. It's an enumerated power. There's a necessary and proper clause that functions to allow Congress to give effect to that treaty. End of story. And she and Sotomayor and I think arguably Justice Ginsburg all took that hard line, as did Solicitor General Verrilli at 7 points during the argument. It's on that hard line interpretation of Missouri versus Holland that there was blowback from Justice Alito, Kennedy, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, and even Justice Breyer. And then the question is, how far do they go in clarifying that blowback and what they're concerned about?
That's exactly right. I think none of them want to say that this power is potentially infinite. None of them will want to write the opinion saying we can enter into a treaty on any subject matter and thus Congress will automatically get the power to regulate that subject matter. It didn't seem like any of those justices wanted to say that, and so they have to say something else. They have to find some limiting principle, either by construing the statute narrowly or construing Missouri v. Holland narrowly or coming up with something else. But nobody seems to want to say, yes, this is potentially infinite.
Gentlemen, we're just about out of time, but let me give you each a chance, 60 seconds, say, for any final thoughts you want to express here. And let's start with Professor Eastman.
Yeah, I just want to commend to everyone's attention Professor Rosenkrantz's really, really fine article in the 2005 issue of the Harvard Law Review on this subject. For a shorter, more layman's version, you can look at the Cato Institute's Supreme Court Review from 2011 that has my article, Will Mrs. Bond Topple Missouri versus Holland, that kind of articulates the broad themes here. And I'd like also to thank the Federal Society for hosting this, but also the wonderful collaboration between our Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, between Professor Rosenkrantz, the Cato Institute, Ed Meese, and the Atlantic Legal Foundation on the brief. We think it's a very important case, and we were delighted to have such profoundly important people weighing in with us on it.
Professor Rosenkrantz, final thought?
I'm very grateful to John for all his kind words and for all the work that he did on our brief for the Cato Institute, the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, and Atlantic Legal Foundation. If you want a shorter version of our views than in my article, you can just have a look at our brief, which is available on SCOTUS blog and elsewhere. But this is a big, important case about the scope of legislative power, and it's good to see the court grappling with these deep, fundamental issues. Hopefully we'll get the sort of ruling that we, the sort of thoughtful ruling we need about scope of legislative power pursuant to treaty.
Best guess, is this a decision that waits till the final day of the term, or are we likely to see a decision between now and then, or any sense?
I don't think it should take them till June from now. I mean, I think this is a hard case, and there may be several opinions, but if you hear it in early November, I think you ought to be able to get it out before June. So I hope we'll see it in the spring.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, let me thank both Professors Rosenkrantz and Eastman. We certainly appreciate you making time to join us today, and as Professor Rosenkrantz as well, for attending oral argument. It's a terrific discussion. To our audience, I encourage you to join our Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. for another special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum, when we'll be discussing the Town of Greece case. That's the legislative prayer case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.